Hello and welcome. This is Emphasis Added, a podcast by the Houston Law Review about legal issues, prominent lawyers, and obscure blue book rules. I'm your host, Drew Padley, editor-in-chief of the Houston Law Review. Before we begin, I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Vinson & Elkins, a global law firm with 13 offices and more than 750 lawyers committed to excellence in serving its sophisticated clients in industries such as energy, finance, technology, real estate, media, and beyond. V&E hires the best and brightest law students and lawyers, valuing diverse perspectives and backgrounds. Visit www.velaw.com to learn more about V&E's summer associate program and hiring opportunities. Start your success story at Vinson & Elkins. Today on the show, we have the full recording of the Houston Law Review's 24th Annual Frankel Lecture, featuring Professor Orly Lobel from the University of San Diego School of Law. The Frankel Lecture is sponsored by the Frankel Family Foundation, and we are incredibly grateful for their support. Professor Lobel's outstanding lecture is followed by commentary from Professor Todd Rakoff of Harvard Law School and Professor Lisa Larimore-Ouellette of Stanford Law School. I'll keep this introduction short because University of Houston Law Center Associate Dean and Faculty Advisor to the Houston Law Review, Professor Dave Fagundes, does such a great job of introducing the lecture in his opening remarks. Finally, please excuse any audio quality issues as this is a recording of a live event. All right, without further ado, please enjoy our 24th annual Frankel Lecture.
It is a real privilege for me to welcome as our keynote speaker, Professor Orly Lobel. Professor Lobel is the Warren Distinguished Professor of Law. Yes, that is correct, what I just said. This has been updated. She's has so many honors, we can barely keep track of them. So she is the Warren Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of San Diego School of Law, where she specializes in intellectual property, employment and labor law, administrative law, and many other topics. Now, you all have her bio in the printed materials, so you can see that she has published more work and won more awards than I have time to list. But on a personal note, what has made me such an admirer of Professor Lobel's work for many years is that, on the one hand, it is steeped in a really sophisticated understanding of the scholarly literature, whether economics or psychology or behavioralism. But on the other hand, it leverages this understanding to deliver insights that are of value not just within the academy, but also to anyone who practices law, participates in markets, or just more generally cares about how innovation policy works or what it means to have fairness in the workplace. We are also very fortunate to have with us today two distinguished commentators to deliver their additional insights on Professor Lobel's lecture, Professors Todd Rakoff and Lisa Larimore-Ouellette. Professor Rakoff is the Byrne Professor of Administrative Law at Harvard Law School. He has served as Dean of Harvard's JD program. He teaches and writes about contract and administrative law and is one of the editors of Gellhorn and Bise's Administrative Law, which is the foundational work in the field, and also just happens to be the book that I used when I was studying administrative law in law school, and I'm sure that's true of many of you all as well. Professor Ouellette is an associate professor as well as the Justin M. Roach Jr. Faculty Scholar at Stanford Law School. Her scholarship addresses empirical and theoretical problems in intellectual property, and she is trained not only as a lawyer, but also as a physicist, which gives her a unique perspective on patents and on the relationship between law and innovation. Here's a little note about the format for today. Professor Lobel is going to speak for about 30 minutes. Then Professors Rakoff and Ouellette will, in that order, have about 15 minutes to share their comments on her work. And then we will open it up to questions and dialogue with the audience. Professor Lobel's lecture is entitled Exit, Voice, and Innovation: How Human Capital Law Impacts Inequality and How Inequality Hurts Growth. It engages the growing trend in private firms to tie up employees' mobility and voice by means of agreements such as non-disclosures and non-competes. Now, presumably, private firms use these agreements increasingly because they believe it's in their self-interest to do so. But Professor Lobel, in her lecture, uses economic theory and empirical research to tell another story about these agreements, one that highlights the extent to which they limit employee voice and exit, as well as the costs they impose on employees, on the firms that use them, and on the economy and on innovation policy more broadly. It is both a fascinating and important take on this increasingly relevant issue. And without further ado, I will turn it over to Professor Lobel.
Thank you. Thank you, Dave, Professor Fagundes. And thank you to University of Houston Law Center, and especially the students of the Law Review who have been incredibly generous and organized and welcoming. I can't tell you what an honor it is to deliver the 24th Annual Frankel Lecture. It's a terrific legacy with so many wonderful talks and articles that came out of these annual lectures, and I am especially honored to have such insightful commentators that are with us to react to some of what I am going to be talking about. And I just love coming to Houston, actually. I love the law school. Thank you, deans, for inviting me. Every time I'm invited to give a talk at Houston, I put on my red dress and I show up. So for this lecture, because it's such a momentous occasion, I wanted to do something that is equally ambitious, I would say, in taking a seminal framework that has been with us since Albert Hirschman, the economist, wrote Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, and said to us that this concept or this framework of exit and voice that is moderated by loyalty can really be, in a very ambitious move, he said, he can really be applied to any context, any place around the world, whether it's firms, organizations, communities, or countries. And this has really informed a lot of thinking in various disciplines. And what I wanted to do was say, we're at a specific moment, and we are in a very particular context of markets and thinking about growth and innovation and dynamics in different industries, and to say, well, maybe we should kind of update this idea that exit and voice alternate, and there might be something to be said about what happens when both exit and voice are reduced by law, by contractual and policy moves that are pervasive in the industry. And so the project is ambitious because it takes four concepts that are usually kept quite distinct and separate: exit, voice, and innovation and equality. And then it also takes four different fields, at least, of law that are usually researched and practiced in kind of distinct ways: contract, intellectual property, employment law, and antitrust law and competition law. And what I try to do is bring them all together in this particular moment and particular dynamics of competitive markets, talent mobility, and innovation policy. And so to do all that ambitious move, I have to take you a little bit a step back to how I see this new project that I wrote for the Law Review and the Frankel Lecture relates to different threads of my research. And for a while now, I've been interested in those intersections between contract, intellectual property, law, the Patent Act, copyright, expansion of trade secrecy, and how it all kind of comes to play in workplaces, in organizations where, as we know, you know, most of our creative activities happen. So I kind of have this map that I've developed. I call it human capital law, where I think about time zero when people are in creative ventures and what are the kinds of doctrines that bind them, that tie them, that assign their creativity and inventiveness to an organization, and then what I call, in some experimental work that I've done, time one, what happens when they want to compete, when they want to leave. And it's really a matrix of, again, law and contract that determines who owns innovation, who can compete, what kinds of knowledge and information can be used in what settings. So it's really both that kind of patchwork of what the Copyright Act might say about work for hire, patent law will say about what is a hired to invent employee versus somebody that wasn't hired for the purpose of R&D. And then also on top of that, what contracts say, which expand quite a bit, as many of you know, what the law, the kind of the lines that have been drawn in intellectual property, contract expands that world of ownership through clauses such as really broad innovation assignment agreements, very broad non-disclosure agreements that define confidential proprietary information beyond what trade secrets defines secrecy, and non-competes, just the kind of their most direct blunt tool of saying employees cannot move from one company to another. And what I've said in my first book, In Talent Wants to Be Free, is exactly what Professor Fagundes said, was that we need to challenge some of the debates, the policy debates that were happening, as though it's an employee issue. I was looking at it from an innovation policy perspective, from what is good for regions, what is good for entrepreneurship, for competition, for growth, and for inventiveness, just like intellectual property and antitrust, that it's an economic policy. So when I was writing Talent Wants to Be Free, this is a few years back now, I argued that this was all happening under the radar, that we were debating intellectual property lines, like what is patentable, what is copyrightable, what is fair use, what can litigants in patent lawsuits do, or the, you know, reforming patent laws, but we weren't talking about this under the radar expansion through contract and through relationships in the market and competition. I have to say that it's been so rewarding and exciting to be in this field, because that is no longer true. In 2016, I got a call from the White House, from the president's policy team, to come speak about Talent Wants to Be Free and to become part of a working group on these precise issues. The Treasury Department issued a report about non-competes, again, thinking about it from an innovation policy. And this working group that I joined of the White House, the President Obama issued in October 2016 a call to the states to really curtail this expansion of these kinds of clauses. And to me, it's always been interesting moving from the East Coast to the West Coast, where we have this exceptional policy in California of not enforcing non-competes. So the other thing that has been happening, when I wrote the book, there was some empirical studies about these kinds of comparisons, but those empirical studies of looking at variations, because it's all contract law, so unlike patent law where you have pretty much one law across the country, here we have these natural experiments of non-compete policy, and also with trade secrets, this is true. There were already indications empirically that this is something that curtailing or non-enforcing some of the most draconian clauses and allowing more, encouraging more mobility, allowing more flow of knowledge or positive spillovers, as we discuss it in economics, is good for regions. Since then, just in the past, I would say 3-4 years, there's been a huge mushrooming around the country, coming out mainly from business schools and econ departments and some psychology departments, industrial organization departments, that support with comparative field studies, empirical data sets, using different methodologies, different places that they study different reforms, longitudinal studies, comparative studies, but there's a critical mass now that is suggests that, yes, we really need to think about this very seriously as innovation policy. So here's just one example that will lead me to kind of talking about patents, and Professor Ouellette will talk about this too. But what we know is just kind of a raw comparison between two regions that have been discussed in the literature, Route 128 in Massachusetts, where Professor Rakoff works, and as he knows, there was just now, that last year, a new bill that moves a little bit more to the California non-enforcement of non-competes, and that's been before the legislature for several years now, versus Silicon Valley and California's non-enforcement of non-compete since the inception of the state. And you see here a mapping of patent inventorship networks, collaborations between creative, inventive people in over time in their patenting activity. And what you see is that the density of a region that allows more mobility and more competition over talent becomes much more dense, there's much more collaboration, and per capita, each inventor becomes more inventive. So kind of this Medici effect, if you will, this idea that in 15th century Italy, we have these places where there's supporters of the arts, the creativity, and the density, the fact that there are a lot of people working in the same place makes each one of us more creative, more knowledgeable, more collaborative, and everybody wins. But what happens on the ground? So, and this is how that third piece of the exit voice, innovation, or fourth piece of equality came into play in my research. So I just told you that in California we don't enforce non-competes, but as you saw in the map of human capital law, it's not just that tool of non-competes. There's lots of ways to restrict mobility, competition, and also internally to restrict impact and voice and inventive activity in workplaces. And so I wanted to bring these questions into California, where I work and live, actually into Southern California with the creative industries, because I thought there was a lot of research on the high-tech industry, about Silicon Valley, and also the financial industries. But what about content production, entertainment industries? And in California, again, we see these very broad expansions, as I said, of what innovation assignments look like, an employee pre-assigning at time zero all their creative capacities, their future ideas, sometimes well into the future post their leaving the workplace, know-how, skills, concepts that are purely in the conceptual stage. So again, for those of you who are intellectual property experts, intellectual property attorneys, you know very well that we have these lines between what is copyrightable, which is concrete expressions, or patentable, things that have been reduced to practice. But beyond that, we think that these other bodies of knowledge are in the public domain, in the commons. But in the contracts, we see this very broad expansion of anything that's even in the conceptual, ephemeral stage, that are pure ideas. The company, in very standard moves, assigns to employees, or assigns from employees to employers. So what was it in this story, that the singular story that I told in You Don't Own Me, that I think triggered some of my interest in equality, and how up to now I was just describing to you how these impediments to exit harm all workers and harm innovation in general. But one of the things in the puzzle was that we were in the story itself, and You Don't Own Me, which I'm now pretty excited. It's going to become a movie, I think. It was optioned, and I'm working on casting people like Judge Kaczynski, who I sat with to talk about his worldview about intellectual property, and the attorneys that litigated this case for over a decade. But it was grown men in the doll industry owning or fighting over who owns and who created these images of fashion dolls. And it struck me that there were no women in this story, even though the story also allowed me to open up kind of those windows of thinking critically about the iconic symbols that we have, parenting, the pink shelf that girls play with. But it was a very male-dominant industry, and there were the two CEOs that were fighting it out. There was the inventor of Bratz, who was a man. And I started looking more into who actually owns and who participates in creative ventures. So again, this is an area that is very researched across campuses, and the patent office has a new study that they just did about patent holders and gender equality. So the news it's not good news when you actually look at, you know, not anecdotally at this one case study, but at the data of participation in inventive ventures. What we see in this graph, and again, there are multiple studies about this, we see that there has been some rise. It's still, if you see the highest is 20% of all patents, there is participation of women versus a half a century ago when there was nearly none. But if you look at it closely, you see that the purple line is the participation of one woman in a team of inventors. So that's been the highest growth, and it's still only 20%. And then when you look at women who actually own, the share of women owning, or not even owning, just being the assigner and have to their name an invention, you see the stagnation in the green and yellow lines, where the projections are that the gap is not going to be closing on its own. It's pretty flat. Some of the projections are that maybe in 150 years in this rate, maybe we'll get to gender parity. That's not good enough to wait a century and a half. And so there's a lot of creative thinking. And of course, there's a lot, and we'll hear from Professor Ouellette, you know, a lot of different causes. We don't know exactly, you know, all of the reasons for this disparity, this gap, this deficit in innovation. There are a lot of experiments that we can undertake, but the reality is really stark, and there has to be something that we're doing, or more than one thing. And in copyright, even though this is less documented, when we talk about copyright law, there's a little bit less of a paper trail, and so we have less neat empirical data on these questions. But it's certainly the case. There's some empirical new studies that show that very similarly, women own a low share of copyright. And I like this data point that's anecdotal, but I think really illuminating. At the Met, if you look at the number of women who are the figures and the, you know, in paintings, it's over 80% of art has a woman depicted in it. But if you count the number of artists, female artists that are represented at the Met, it's under 5%. So that's a striking disparity. And as I said, you know, this is a loss, and an urgency that is about equality, but it's also about innovation. What about all of these, as one study calls it, the lost Einsteins, all of these people who had the capacity, who showed real promise at the beginning of their childhood and then disappear, and a lot of it is correlated with socioeconomic class, their background. There is a race deficit, just like there's a gender deficit. But the lost Einsteins is kind of, that's the way that these Harvard Business scholars, business school scholars talk about their study about an innovation deficit. But it's really a misnomer because they find, like so many others, that it's lost Marie Curie's or lost Frida Kahlo's, that we have this deficit that affects all of us, that affects what we have in our culture, in our progress in arts and sciences. And so now, pulling it together with Exit and Voice, what I argue is that while non-competes and exit restrictions and voice restrictions hurt everybody in the creative ventures, and they harm innovation in general, and the evidence I think is quite strong on this, we also have a disproportionate harm for gender equality. And there's a lot of different reasons that I kind of go through of how just the way that we interact and our gender norms mean that already women have more search friction or more geographic restrictions in moving. They're more likely on average to have a spouse that also has to coordinate their careers. And so adding extra additional restrictions can really create that compound, that impediment of competing. There's also this perverse irony here where women, as we know in this moment, they often have stronger non-monetary preferences and choosing a workplace that is, for example, free of harassment and that takes their voice more seriously, that is a more diverse workplace. And once they have more of those restrictions, again, or more of these preferences, restrictions on moving to a place that is more open and diverse or doesn't have a hostile work environment, that's something that they have a strong preference for, but also can't move if they have these restrictions that say you have to either stay in somewhere that you're unhappy or leave the industry altogether. And I also think that there are a lot of documented behavioral differences in risk aversion and negotiation differences that have meant that women might be less likely to challenge some of these restrictions. And again, I think we see this in negotiation differences on trying to use a competitive tournament over one's talent and get higher pay. We see this in risk aversion and trying to litigate against the enforceability of certain restrictions. And so we have to take that into account in this facially neutral restrictions that may have a greater effect on decision making by women's mobility. And then finally, just the kind of global economic idea. This is Gary Becker, the Nobel laureate Gary Becker's idea of how equality will happen. It happens when we have truly competitive markets. So if there is competition over those low-hanging fruit of people who have been traditionally discriminated against, who are underpaid, who are undervalued, there will be, if there is a competitive labor market, there will be an attempt to correct that. And what we see, and again, this is from the empirical literature, and this is where the antitrust division now in Washington has been really getting involved in this question of non-competes. We see that the question of concentration and competition has been neglected when we talk about labor markets. So, you know, the focus has always been on product markets and what happens when we do price fixing and what happens when we have quasi-monopolies over certain products. But what happens when we have too few competitors in the labor market? And the evidence now is coming out that what we have today is actually more concentration in the labor markets than in the product markets. And it's, again, been very rewarding because Professor Rakoff and I are part of a petition to the FTC to think about the question of non-competes. And just in the past 2 weeks, I've been on two conference calls with FTC regulators, and we're having a workshop on this issue in January. And so the other piece of it is that when we have restrictions on leaving one's organization, what I think Hirschman didn't capture is how leaving is also patterned. It's not just that you choose between staying at your company or going to another company. There are lots of different choices that are made. For example, whether to go on your own and found a new company, whether to go to an incumbent that might indemnify you if somebody feels like they might be breaching a restriction in their contractual agreement. And there might be also exits that leave the traditional labor market altogether. And I won't go through all of these, but one of the things that we know from non-competes research is that there's a particular harm to entrepreneurship, to those new entries of startups into an industry, because they experience more risk and more problems of hiring the most experienced and the best of the best minds. And employees also choose to move to incumbents where they have that safety, and they choose less to found new companies. And we see this also again with a disproportionate path of not founding new companies as women. And again, a lot of statistics about less venture capital investment in women-owned startups and so forth. One of the interesting studies about what happens when women just choose to not participate in traditional work, and I call it gig exit, there's a study that was done recently about these online markets to solve problems, inventive capacities where, like, a chemical plant needs a developer that will really solve a particular problem, and their R&D division just can't figure it out. And so an incentive is this online global competition that allows people that maybe have nothing to do with the industry, they're not even working right now, and they can submit suggestions. And the hypothesis of these researchers, also coming out of the Harvard Business School, was that if women are more driven out of the traditional inventive markets or industries, then maybe they will actually win more competitions, and they'll actually be more better positioned to succeed in these non-traditional kind of markets or online competitions. And that's what they find, that women actually are winning much more frequently because they oftentimes are kind of rooted out of the traditional path. And then finally, with voice, again, this has been in the news so much recently, these findings of systemic hiding, a toxic silence, secrecy that come with agreements to not talk about things that are unlawful, that are problematic in a workplace. And at this point I've served on several cases where, as an expert, I started to say trade secrecy was, and non-disclosure agreements, they were designed to protect technological innovation, to promote progress in that kind of innovation. And it was not contemplated, and it should not be extended to questions like whether there was sexual harassment in a workplace, what is the salary, and whether there's a wage gap in a workplace. But we see these moves very frequently, and what that means is that when people are signing away their right to speak and to know and to have information about the dynamics in workplaces, they're also less likely to have impact and to know how to change their organization from within. So one of the interesting cases that I talk about in the paper is in the Salk Institute, where women scientists, they stayed. They were tenured women primary investigators, full professors in this world-class research institute, but they experienced what the research calls the chilly climate, where these are kind of not specific things of demotion or firing, but they got less access to present their work before donors, to get grants, to hire postdocs. They had much smaller labs than their fellow male scientists, and so all of these I describe as voice and access, and I think they are really compounded. There are lots of reasons for it, but it's compounded by this effect of secrecy and a culture of not speaking and having repercussions when people speak out. I didn't even mention arbitration clauses and waivers of class actions, but I think it's all part of the same question and issues that we're talking about here. And I'll just mention finally that I have a series of experimental studies where I think it's quite intuitive that if we are stripped from our human capital, from our capacity to invent, to contribute, and then to have those skills and knowledge and ideas move with us throughout our trajectory of our careers, the motivation, just behaviorally, our motivation is depressed, is less to perform well, and to contribute. What Hirschman would call, you know, to have voice and impact in one's organization. So I'll end with, I think, the good news and a personal note. I think that when we do shift our lens to thinking about these issues of equality and the right to pursue, the freedoms to pursue one's careers in general, and specifically to certain underrepresented demographics, if we shift all of that conversation to thinking about this as a win-win, as an economic policy, as something that industries will want to, we'll see, and I think we see this, the best actors in markets taking note of this and trying to do better. And I do think we have these examples. I have been thinking about these issues. I told you that I kind of started with my first book, but it's not true. I've been thinking about these issues since my mother put me in her experiments. She's a researcher at Tel Aviv University, and she made me, at the age of 7, pose in different videos where people, her subjects, looked at this girl playing with girl toys versus boy toys. And she asked her subjects, In each condition, is this girl smart? Is she likely to succeed? Is she likely to be a leader and to invent in markets? And it was consistent that when this little girl, myself, was holding the boy toys, I was thought of as, you know, having all of those positive qualities much more. And this was all over the world, these studies. And so we have to think about it starting really early, but we have to think about it in our structures and policies in the market. And so the Lost Einsteins are The lost Marie Curies, the lost Frida Kahlos. I have three daughters now, and so I care about this topic a lot, and I look forward to comments and to all of the discussion. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm sorry I don't have any pictures of either me age seven or my daughter age seven to share with you. Professor Lobel has given us a very interesting paper, and I'm especially impressed by her showing how the economist's simple views of exit and voice are in fact very complicated ideas with a substantial legal structure. But the part of the paper I want to talk about is the connection between human capital law and gender equality, and I'm going to talk especially about non-compete clauses because I teach contract law and I don't teach IP law, so that's what I know about. I should say right off, as Professor Lobel mentioned, that if we fundamentally agree as to what the social policy ought to be. We're both petitioners to the Federal Trade Commission. We're on a petition to the Federal Trade Commission to have covenants not to compete prohibited as an unfair trade practice. Where we'll get to, I don't know, but we both agree that that would be desirable. Now, one can be against these clauses for many reasons. You can argue, as Professor Lobel does argue, that they're bad economic policy leading to a less creative economy. One could argue that they're transactionally unfair because workers get very little in exchange for saying how they're going to live their year or two after their leave. I'm against them as a matter of freedom. I'm a believer in free labor. As Professor Lobel very nicely sets out, these clauses affect freedom both in terms of exit and in terms of voice. The slide, one of the slides she showed made the point that exiting is often a very positive act. We tend to use the word quit and we tend to have a negative connotation to the word quit, but quitting and doing something else is the American tradition. It is what immigrants did. It is what people who moved to the frontier did. All those things that we think of as the great creative things that created the country started with leaving something else and deciding to do something more entrepreneurial or more inventive. And this right to quit, this important right socially, depends on, of course, the capability to quit. And telling people, as the covenants not to compete do, telling people that when you quit, you can't go on doing just what you were normally doing is a great penalty on the ability to exit. It's also true that the workers subject to these clauses get very little in return for signing away their freedom for the next year or two. And it's also true that in the recent years, these clauses have been used more and more for just very ordinary occupations. These are not fancy employees only. These are employees who are non-exempts under the Fair Labor Standards Act. And I mean, I was struck last night. I was talking to several very good, really had a terrific conversation with several 3Ls on the Law Review about what they're planning to do. They're planning to go to Houston law firms, after they pass the bar, practice. And they struck me as very good, and I hope it all works out. But supposing it doesn't work out for them, what would it be like to, lawyers fortunately are not subject to these non-competes, but what would it be like it doesn't work out with the law firm that you started with, and you signed one of these things, and you'd have to either stop practicing law, or depending on how it's written, leave either Houston or Texas in order to continue practicing law? What kind of weird world would it be to start a job with the thought that the only possibility is a tremendous cost if it doesn't work out? That's an example of voice being lost, because that puts you in a terribly subservient position in that new job. Well, I'm not up here really to talk about what I have to say, but to talk about what Professor Lobel had to say. So I want to move on to this question of gender equality. Professor Lobel gives us a lot of data in the paper, and to the effect that one or more contractual or property right leads to gender inequality results. And I don't want to discuss the data and the studies. That's what the third commentator, or the second commentator, will do. I want to stipulate that that's true and then ask, what does that add up to? All right. One thing it adds up to is it's bad for the economy, and Professor Lobel has argued that in several papers. But I take it in this paper that she also wants to argue that it's wrong. And so the question I want to raise is it wrong because it's unequal, or is it wrong because it's discriminatory? So these are not the same things, although often in common language we confuse them. Take, for example, the claim that covenants not to compete are bad because there's a general social practice that families are more likely to move to find a new job for a husband than they are to move to find a new job for a wife. And that means that a covenant not to compete with a geographical restriction, which is the way they're normally written, reduces the woman's job opportunities more than it reduces the man's opportunities, because the family will move for the new opportunity for the man, and they won't move for the new opportunity for a woman. So this is certainly a claim that covenants work out to have unequal results, right? But is it a claim of discrimination? The question matters, I think, because rightly or wrongly, we have very, very different cultural valences to those two arguments. All right. Our society is notoriously, I might put it, accepting of social inequality, even patterned social inequality, while we are at the same time strongly opposed to invidious discrimination. So people may argue that there's not much difference between them, but at least I think as a legal matter, being down and out is very different from being subordinated and discriminated against. And the law treats those things very, very differently. So do we have an argument of inequality, or do we have an argument of discrimination, is of substantial cultural and legal importance. I'm not sure which it is that Professor Lobel wants to claim, and I'll leave that for her. But the starting point for the distinction would be the cases in the 1970s that were race discrimination cases. Washington v. Davis and the Arlington Heights case, where the Supreme Court distinguished between official action which is merely shown to have a racially disproportionate impact, and official action, which has a racially discriminatory purpose, which was one of the actual motivating factors in the action that was taken. The court's principal argument for making the distinction was that disproportionate impact was much too broad a category. It could be true of tax law, regulatory law, licensing statutes, all kinds of things could have a disproportionate impact. And presumably the court was also responding in its focus on actual intent to a sense that discrimination, as distinguished from merely differentiation, that discrimination requires some element of wrongfulness, some element of subordination in it. Now, if we take our conceptual universe to just have these two choices, that is to say, it's either disparate impact or it's discriminatory intent, we'd have to say that the covenants not to compete do not meet the discriminatory intent test. They began long before women flooded into the labor markets. There's no indication that they are extracted only from women and not from men. And as far as I know, there's no indication that they're enforced more against women than against men. If those things were different, then I'd have a different view. But just taking the facts as it appears, there's no discriminatory intent. And if we say the only choices are discriminatory intent or discriminatory or differential impact, then they are not an example of discrimination. Now the question is, can we ask a more subtle question which makes that a more complicated question to answer? And I think we can. Do things which are neutral on their face, non-discriminatory in appearance, become discriminatory if they are adopted or used in a social reality which itself is discriminatory? That's a question halfway between impact and intent. It's saying this thing that we're looking at only has impact, but the background against which it operates makes it look different. Now, I think that we do think that there are things like that are discriminatory. Well, the easy case is if the actor who is doing it was the cause of the prior discrimination. So if a company now adopts a totally neutral pay by seniority rule, but the ability to get seniority in the past depended on gender-inflected decisions, such that men have more seniority or more seniority in the more attractive jobs than women do, then I think it's not a hard case to say now adopting the seniority rule, which might be applied totally neutrally on its face, is in fact discriminatory because it carries forward the prior discrimination. I don't think many fact finders would have a trouble reaching that result. But can we make the same kind of argument with regard to discrimination or differentiation in the social sphere that was not caused by this very same actor? Now, a very good recent article by Deborah Hellman at the University of Virginia Law School says the answer to that is yes. And you can see what her thesis is from the title of her article. She wrote an article called Indirect Discrimination and the Duty to Avoid Compounding Injustice. Example, suppose this is actually an example Professor Lobel has written about. Suppose a company has the practice of asking prospective employees, what were you paid as your previous job? And suppose they have a practice of giving an offer of 10% more than whatever the answer they get. So it's a totally neutral question, and it's a totally equal application of the what they learn. But they know, or they ought to know, that women have been paid less than men in their prior jobs. And so the application of that rule of asking for what was the previous salary and giving it exactly the same equal treatment to the answer, in fact, has a substantially disproportionate effect. And if you think that I'm right when I say they know or they should have known what the social circumstances were in which they were asking that question, then you might be willing to make the further step and say that asking that question and acting on it is discriminatory and is not merely a differential impact. That's what Professor Hellman argues, and at least some state legislatures have accepted that argument. Now, I'm not sure we can make a similar argument about the covenants not to compete. For example, Professor Lobel says the covenants not to compete operate negatively against women. One of the reasons is because women aren't as likely to be risk takers when they think about the set of alternatives that face them once they have left a previous job. Again, if we accept that that's what the data show, that looks to me kind of closer to the kind of just having a differential impact part of the spectrum than it does to the question of carrying forward a prior discriminatory practice. If instead we can connect covenants not to compete to things, some of the other things that Professor Lobel says, such as women in science and technological settings not getting enough lab space, not being listed as the principal investigator, not being included in the patent, then the hit to their CVs that all that implies might be a reason for saying that they face a worse set of choices when they're struggling with what to do, having had a covenant not to compete. So I'm not saying that it's impossible to make the showing. I'm saying right now, I don't think we can claim that covenants not to compete have been shown to be discriminatory. That doesn't mean they're not unequal. And I guess the bottom line of what I'm saying, to go back what I've said to begin with, is Professor Lobel and I agree on what should be done, but maybe we vary on the why it should be done. Thank you.
So I want to thank the University of Houston Law Center and the editors of the Houston Law Review for organizing what I think has been a terrific event so far. I have long admired Professor LaBelle's work, and so it is an honor to be asked to comment on her Frankel lecture. And I also want to thank my fantastic co-author on this commentary, Amy Model, a former student of mine who recently decided to return to science to finish her PhD at Stanford. So the issue of gender equality among innovators is not just of academic interest to her. So in her Frankel lecture, Professor LaBelle has set forth what I think is an intriguing hypothesis, that non-competes, non-disclosure agreements, and other legal restrictions on employee exit and voice exacerbate the innovation gender gap. The unequal participation of women in science, technology, and innovation is a critical social policy problem that, as she noted, raises concerns for both equity and efficiency. And it is delightful to see Professor LaBelle apply her wide-ranging expertise to this issue. I think those interested in increasing innovation by women would be well advised to consider Professor LaBelle's ideas. But the main point I want to emphasize during my time today is that the underlying causal mechanisms for inequalities among innovators remain highly contested, and it's important not to overstate the existing evidence for potential interventions out of a desire for rapid progress. Rather, I think institutions and scholars and policymakers interested in this issue should be looking for opportunities to rigorously test the most promising interventions, including some of Professor LaBelle's ideas. There are a lot of ways to measure innovation, but by any of these metrics, progress on increasing participation of underrepresented groups in the innovation ecosystem has been glacial. As Professor LaBelle noted, if current trends continue, gender inequality will persist for US patent inventors for well over a century. Private and public sector stakeholders are demanding more rapid progress. Private technology firms face heightened scrutiny about their diversity practices. Universities are under fire to increase the percentage of female academics in science and engineering. Two of the first bills signed by President Trump in 2017 were bipartisan efforts to advance women in STEM fields. In 2018, Congress charged the Patent Office with providing recommendations on how to increase the percentage of women and minority filing patents. And I think this swell of interest is an opportunity for real policy change, but it also creates risks. As summarized in one recent article, the hunger to fix a real problem with diversity in the tech industry has fed a cottage industry of companies posing dubious statistics that are shared uncritically by news organizations, as in the New York Times citation of an unfounded claim that resume blinding increased the percentage of women receiving job offers from 5 to 54%. Best current evidence suggests that resume blinding would actually do relatively little to address gender diversity among tech workers. But if policymakers view this as a quick fix, it can divert attention from policy recommendations that are likely to have a larger effect and can lead to disappointment if no intervention actually has this kind of dramatic impact. So I think it's critically important to think carefully about the underlying mechanisms by which any proposed policy change might increase innovation by women and other underrepresented groups, to examine what evidence there is about that benefit, to weigh the size of that benefit against the costs of the intervention, and to think about how better evidence of those costs and benefits might be acquired. So today I'll focus on two general policy recommendations stemming from Professor LaBelle's lecture: increasing workplace transparency, such as by limiting the information that can be protected by NDAs, and promoting worker mobility by limiting the enforceability of non-compete agreements. On workplace transparency, Professor LaBelle highlights three particular kinds of information whose secrecy may exacerbate gender inequality among innovators: information about claims of sexual misconduct, diversity data and strategies, and salary information. She does not explicitly lay out the mechanisms under which lack of transparency about each type of information could affect the innovation gender gap, so I'll begin by trying to unpack these effects. First, on sexual misconduct, Professor LaBelle states that many of the claims that have emerged through the Me Too movement have been hidden by NDA-protected settlement agreements and mandatory arbitration. Lack of transparency about these claims may have allowed harassers to continue in their employment and contributed to hostile work environments in which women did not feel welcome or comfortable, making them less likely to join or remain at these firms. I think this conjecture is plausible and consistent with reports that women in STEM perceive a less supportive climate than men do. And there are at least some reasons to believe that harassment may be more prevalent in STEM workplaces. But the full causal hypothesis here is not just that sexual harassment may explain part of the innovation gender gap. It's that prohibiting NDA-protected settlement agreements will lead to more transparency about harassment in ways that reduce its prevalence, and that this change will be more substantial in R&D workplaces in ways that influence women's choices of STEM versus non-STEM careers. And I think that the evidence for each step of this causal chain is largely anecdotal at this point. And drawing clear policy conclusions requires not just understanding those pieces of evidence, but also the non-innovation effects of bans on NDA-protected settlements, such as whether they increase litigation costs or make it more difficult for harassment victims to recover compensation. The second kind of NDA-protected information Professor LaBelle highlights is diversity data and strategies. Now, it's not obvious to me that secrecy for diversity strategies would depress diversity, because to the extent that strategies for recruiting and retaining diverse talent provide a competitive advantage, the conventional economic logic of IP would suggest that allowing these strategies to be protected through trade secret law incentivizes their production. For diversity data, however, I agree with Professor LaBelle that the arguments in favor of allowing secrecy seem weak. I'm not aware of any evidence indicating how much either requiring or allowing disclosure would actually move the needle on the innovation gender gap, but it seems plausible that it might have at least some impact at relatively low cost. Finally, on salary information, Professor LaBelle notes evidence that state bans on pay secrecy reduce the gender wage gap. Although there are also studies showing that the net effect of full pay transparency can be to lower overall salaries and decrease overall worker satisfaction. But to my knowledge, there's not evidence about the effect of pay transparency on gender disparities in innovation. So even if pay transparency increases women's salaries, it may not increase innovation by women if it also makes non-innovation related careers more attractive. And there's some evidence that the gender pay gap is smaller in R&D industries than other fields, such that decreasing the gap overall might actually increase relative incentives for non-STEM jobs. So in addition to advocating for greater workplace transparency, Professor LaBelle recommends promoting innovation by women through limiting enforceability of non-compete agreements. And I'll note at the outset that the effects of non-compete agreements on the innovation gender gap is likely small compared with their broader social effects. As she described, Professor LaBelle has argued in prior work that non-compete agreements have a net negative effect on social welfare, including by depressing overall innovation. And if that's correct, widespread adoption of California-like bans on non-compete agreements may be the right public policy, regardless of their effect on gender diversity. But here I limit my focus to that of this Frankel lecture, whether this policy intervention seems effective for increasing innovation by women. So in her written draft, Professor LaBelle's argument about the effects of non-compete enforceability on the innovation gender gap depend heavily on three unpublished manuscripts, which she says consistently confirm that non-competes harm women more than men. For example, one of these studies suggests that moving from the 90th to the 10th percentile of non-compete enforceability accounts for about 6 to 7% of the gender wage gap. Now, my reading, these studies are the most robust evidence that Professor LaBelle presents of contractual restrictions on employees having widespread disparate gender effects. But it's worth emphasizing that none of these studies are focused on any measure of innovation outcomes, and the mechanism through which non-compete enforceability might decrease the innovation gender gap is not clear. Even if banning non-competes causes a small amount of the gender pay gap to close across industries, this may do little to increase innovation by women if it also makes non-innovation work more attractive. Anecdotally, California, with its famous longstanding ban on enforcing non-competes, ranks below 7 other states in share of female patent inventors. Delaware, the state with the highest female inventor rate, enforces reasonable non-competes. So perhaps I've convinced you at this point that a policymaker looking for evidence-supported interventions to decrease the innovation gender gap probably wouldn't put increasing workplace transparency or limiting non-compete enforceability at the top of their list, though they might think these are good ideas for other reasons. I suspect that policymaker would top their list with interventions that seem more directly targeted to this problem. For example, if the innovation gender gap is driven by insufficient economic resources or incentives, then the most natural policy intervention would be to address those financial problems directly, rather than through policy reforms that have a more tangential effect on returns to innovation. Another targeted policy that's attracted significant interest is pipeline programs to provide mentorship for women in STEM, as well as corresponding programs for underrepresented racial minorities. Such programs have proliferated at every stage of the STEM pipeline. So you might think that widespread programs specifically focused on the innovation gender gap would be supported by solid evidence of effectiveness, and that I'm bringing up these programs to contrast Professor Lobel's policy recommendations with those that have a stronger empirical foundation. Not so. I mention these programs to illustrate that even the most straightforward interventions have surprisingly little evidence to back them. Many of these programs track participant outcomes, but not against a valid comparison group, and not with any attempt to figure out what program aspects are actually cost-effective. It wouldn't be hard for some of these programs, perhaps in collaboration with interested academics, to introduce randomization into their program acceptances, or to use a regression discontinuity analysis with waitlisted applicants to figure out if the programs really work. But they don't. I regularly read about actual or proposed policy interventions without solid evidentiary support. That doesn't mean that these are bad ideas, or that policymakers should just sit on their hands and do nothing. Rather, the key point I want to emphasize today is that I think the most promising policies should be regularly tested in ways that facilitate rigorous evaluation. So in prior work, I've made the case for more robust use of policy experimentation to make empirical progress on patent and innovation policy. And I'm trying to do this with my own work. I've argued in earlier law review articles that patent examination might be improved through expert input, and then I put this to the test. I recently finished a randomized field experiment for which I recruited hundreds of scientists to provide input on US patent applications. And the process actually made me more skeptical that this intervention would be the most cost-effective way to improve patent examination. I think more legal scholars should be trying to do this kind of empirical test, including by partnering with institutions that are interested in policy change. Those institutions could involve different levels of government. Hundreds of government-designed policy experiments have already been conducted, and some agencies, such as the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, have shown a willingness to pilot policies in ways that leverage randomization. But governments are not the only stakeholders capable of policy experimentation. Nonprofit organizations, private employers, and academic institutions are all equipped to study the gendered effects of promising interventions. And many seem motivated to do so. To give just one concrete example of how this might work with one of Professor Lobel's hypotheses, I think employment platforms like LinkedIn and Glassdoor may be well suited to test interventions around non-compete agreements. Turns out there's little correlation between the incidence of non-compete agreements in practice and their level of enforcement, such that even in states that do not enforce them, like California and North Dakota, have an estimated 19% of labor force participants with non-compete clauses in their employment contracts. So just as a team of economists randomly informed University of California workers about an existing salary database to study the effects of pay transparency, a platform like LinkedIn could randomly inform innovation workers in California about non-enforceability of non-competes, and studied the rate of lateral moves among informed innovation workers compared to similarly situated workers who did not receive the notice. I think the problem of inequality among innovators is daunting, but is at least more tractable than most innovation-related problems, because the desired outcome is clear. We want to increase the participation of underrepresented groups in the innovation ecosystem. There are many policy interventions that might plausibly address this problem, and many institutions could implement tests of these interventions. Legal scholars are well positioned to work with these institutions to tackle the most pressing social problems. And we should. Effective solutions, including effective laws, are unlikely to arise organically. And the alternative to dramatic, evidence-based policy change is grave. Another century of inequality among American innovators and those they innovate for. Thank you.
All right, thanks so much, Professor Lobel, for your lecture, and Professors Rakoff and Willett for your great comments. So we have a little bit of time left for questions from the audience. We also have some technology we need to use for that. We have one microphone for the folks at the lectern, and then one microphone that we will pass around for those of you Phil Donahue style, if you have a question you'd like to ask.
Hello, this is Greg Vetter at the law school. Thank you for three wonderful talks. The whole conversation and the slide about ownership of copyright at the Met makes me wonder if what you think about the following application of those ideas. I'm thinking about the performance right in copyright, which until we had a digital world, you know, you did not give to performers. And I always sort of understood that by the broadcaster didn't want to have to pay two owners. But I'm now kind of wondering, and maybe Dave or someone knows that there's some scholarship about this, maybe the performance right also wasn't given because so many more of the performers would have been female than the actual owners of the copyright in that era. So what do you think about that? And maybe someone knows the answer.
I'm the someone? Yeah, so that is the traditional story, but I think it's a plausible counter-conjecture, right? So the idea is that typically we said, hey, you know, if you're a radio station, you don't want to have to pay a royalty to both a performer and the composer of music, right? So I think that whether that conjecture works depends on whether it's empirically true that performers tend to be members of underrepresented groups. And I think we might imagine that they are, but then it also has to be that they're comparatively more members of underrepresented groups than composers as well, which I think is plausible, but I would want to see numbers before I was confident saying that that's the case. But I haven't heard anyone propound that as an explanation. It's an interesting one.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of scholarship, though, coming out. My friend and colleague in San Diego, KJ Green, has been writing several articles about the exclusion of black musicians and performers from ownership over copyright, from the rewards of music, of the music industry. And another scholar in Los Angeles, John Taranian, has a new paper about copyright and women performers. So, you know, there's a history, again, as you suggest, and as Dave said, of the ownership resting with the director, the person behind the camera, the behind the screen, but the person on screen has very little control. So it's not just ownership, it's really credit and control over what is the art and the product. And so I think Dave is right that we need more evidence, and I am completely supportive of everything that Professor Ouellette said about doing more research and more data, but I think that we have this sense, and intuitively we know it to be true, that there is that disparity between who gets the power and the rewards and who are the people that are also are contributing to creative ventures.
Hi, I'm Miriam. I'm part of the Law Review here. Thank you guys so much. Obviously, I'm pretty sure everyone's enjoyed this. I guess my question is, Can you comment on the impact on exit on same-sex couples who are female and how that could possibly be construed as discriminatory if it prevents both members of the couple from entering or force them to leave the STEM field altogether if they feel like they have no voice?
I mean, that's a really interesting question. One study that I talk about in the paper is about power couples and how they are much more likely to find work in metropolitans. And again, it's the region that gains. It gains twice, really, from the interstate mobility and then drawing the most creative couples into a place. And I think with same-sex couples, there is that kind of maybe more internal equality of more likelihood of both members to need work and want work and to support each other's work. Again, this is things that I haven't written about, and we would need more direct knowledge. But I think that we see this. There's a great researcher, sociologist, Richard Florida, who's written about the creative class. It's actually been a series of bestsellers, the creative class books, where he shows that he has this gay index and he has a bohemian index, and he shows that connection actually directly between innovation and diversity of cities. He goes all around the country and looks at where are cities that are more open to same-sex couples that have more rights and offerings, and so that's the gay index, but also kind of more diversity in the arts and bohemian, that's a bohemian index, and then patenting rates and entrepreneurship rates, and he shows those correlations. So I think it's a really good point to kind of delve into even more.
I'll just make the broader point that I think it's an interesting hypothesis. We've been speaking a lot today about the gender gap in innovation. The data that we have on this is largely due to just very coarse matching of names with predicted gender, because often there isn't, like, you're not required when you're filing a patent to indicate what gender you identify with, and so it's just at this very broad statistical level. And that's part of why there's more studies on gender than on the racial gap in innovation, which in some ways is even worse, but it's harder to get those measures. So I think, like, one of the things that the patent office perhaps should consider doing is collecting demographic information on the innovators who are applying for patents to facilitate this kind of study.
Hi, my name is Adriana Langemeyer. I'm a 2L at the Law Center on the Law Review. I had a question just regarding kind of your research and the intersection with anti-SLAPP statutes. I'm not sure if you're aware of the recent changes in the Texas Citizen Participation Act, but it now excludes employment actions, so non-competes and the like. And so I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are of the impact of that on exit and gender.
So I don't know specifically about Texas changes, but I think that this is a really good point that goes to what Professor Roulette was mentioning at the very end of her talk, where one thing that we know, and it's really so much of my book, You Don't Own Me, and a lot of my recent research, that there is a lot of frivolous litigation. There's a lot of non-enforceable, unenforceable contracts that exist also in regions or states that have the right policy, in my opinion. There's a lot of attorneys and corporations that kind of disregard that law, and being able to defend against these kinds of lawsuits is very, very difficult. So I actually very much have argue that we should use, in California we have PAGA, which is the Private Attorney General Act, that actually specifically applies to the employment context, and kind of creating more of that proactive approach of being able to defend, being able to maybe make an anti-slap move or whatever scheme you want to make sure that law in action is actually something that aligns with the policies. We can have a lot of great policies in the book, but because we know about the disparities in defending litigation and going all the way in the courtroom and the disparities in resources, it won't be a reality without those kind of procedural laws that we need.
This question of contractual pieces of contractual language which are in contracts and are not enforceable is really a very surprising thing. I mean, because back of it is some lawyer, these things are all written by lawyers, back of it is some lawyer who thought, well, it's unenforceable, I know it's unenforceable, but I'll throw it in. Maybe somebody will be deceived into thinking it's enforceable. And, you know, let the other side worry about it if they want to say it's unenforceable. The statistics that Professor Lobel brought out about that there's a huge number of California employees who have in their contracts covenants not to compete, even though it's clear under, just as clear as it could be under California statute law that they're unenforceable, you could, there are other examples too. There are, you know, landlords who have pieces of their leases that say we waive the warranty of habitability in states where it's absolutely clear that you can't waive the warranty of habitability. When I've talked to practicing lawyers about it, they sort of have taken the, well, it's unenforceable, but there's no penalty for putting it in. That's a pretty cheesy response, right? I mean, it's really surprising to me that the bar associations wouldn't consider that to be a violation of professional ethics to put into a contract something that you know is unenforceable. I'm not talking about things that are arguable. But I can't, unfortunately, report to you that I know a whole lot of bar associations that have taken that point of view.
This is a question really for all four of you all. Have you all done any work? My name is David Bissinger. I'm a practicing trial lawyer here in Houston with some focus in IP and non-compete and trade secret litigation. But my question is aimed at the recent Fair Play to Pay Act that Governor Gavin Newsom in California recently signed. And have any of you all considered the impact in NCAA sports on suddenly paying players in, say, Division I football and things like that, many millions of dollars, the impact of that just, I think, in general on the labor market for sports and then assessing or how that would be played out among all the different sports, say, besides football and basketball, which might draw many millions of dollars versus other sports like fencing or, you know, field hockey or lacrosse. Has anyone, do you all have any thoughts on that sort of looming issue?
Thank you. I actually have a couple of students writing about this act, and I think one of the things is also, again, relating to IP and developments that I'm not an expert on is the right to persona, which is kind of the neglected stepchild of intellectual property about your images, and with athletes, it's really played a key role, and student athletes. I just don't know enough about the sports industry, and I'm not American, and so I don't know about football, and how, but I think these are all very much related about, you know, who contributes to wealth creation in an industry and then who gains. It's all of these. This is maybe a good point to, or a good place to respond to Professor Rakoff's question of kind of the why and the legal restructures. And I agree that not everything should be deemed discrimination under Title VII or the Civil Rights Act or state law. But it doesn't mean that there's not a role for policy. So that kind of reform that you're talking about, it tackles inequities by policy reforms of bodies of law, of regulating industries that are not, you know, taking these. I think that we've been too court-centric and litigation model-centric and discrimination-centric on correcting inequalities, and in that I absolutely agree with you that there's that, you know, huge land of seeing, you know, all of these market impacts and history impacts and this kind of immobilization or paralyzing, you know, fear that, well, but if that's not what our discrimination laws have deemed unlawful. But it doesn't mean that there are not a lot of other reforms, like in the sports industry, that we can take and can make to make them more competitive and to have these market failures corrected.
So there's a lot more to say, but unfortunately we are at the top of the hour, and that means we need to wrap up. So I hope you all can please join me in thanking Professors Lobel, Ouellette, and Rakoff for making the 24th annual Frankel Lecture a great success.
Emphasis Added is a podcast by the Houston Law Review. Production is possible because of generous support from the Houston Law Review Alumni Association and from Vinson & Elkins. If you have thoughts on today's episode or suggestions for a future episode, email me at eic@houstonlawreview.org. Be sure to follow the Houston Law Review on Twitter and Instagram at HoustonLRev. That's Houston, L-R-E-V. Or find us on Facebook under the name Houston Law Review.